Good morning. On today's programme, the challenges faced by female migrant workers in Lebanon and the discovery of Ernest Shackleton's lost ship. But first we go to France, which is bracing itself for a day of high drama as voters go to the polls for a second round of voting in the National Assembly. In the first round last week, the far-right National Rally, the party of Marine Le Pen, emerged victorious with more than 29% of the vote. But a push by left and centre-left parties in the past week has seen a shift in the polls, meaning the result is far from clear-cut and will likely leave France in a state of political turmoil. From Paris, Sharon Gaffney reports.
If opinion polls are to be believed, the far-right National Rally is set to fall short of an outright majority following today's high-stakes runoff vote. But it is likely to succeed in more than doubling its seats in Parliament to anything between 170 and 210, emerging as the largest party. Coming in second position, ahead of the president's struggling centrist alliance, the New Popular Front. It's a broad coalition of the centre-left, hard-left and the Greens, created after Emmanuel Macron's shock decision to call the snap election. But the country's complex voting system, combined with the past week's tactical manoeuvring, make today's result difficult to predict. More than 200 centrist and left-wing candidates have pulled out of the race since last Sunday's first round in a bid to block the National Rally by boosting the chances of their moderate rivals. The tactic may have reduced the far-right's chances of securing an absolute majority, but Marine Le Pen and her allies have wider and deeper support than ever before, and ultimately it will be voters who decide. The National Rally has denounced the move as a bid to steal victory against the will of the people. The staunchly anti-government party has worked hard to reposition itself as a progressive political force, but remains deeply rooted in the history of the far right. Among its priorities for government, a proposal to drastically reduce both legal and illegal immigration, and a pledge to protect the French people from being submerged by a flood of foreigners. At the heart of its election manifesto, a plan to introduce a so-called French preference, which would actively discriminate against immigrants seeking to access housing, jobs and social welfare benefits. Such policies would require amendments to the constitution. Others would be contrary to EU law, but that doesn't appear to be deterring supporters. Amid the political horse trading, it's unclear how voters will respond, particularly those who saw their preferred candidates withdraw. Instead of transferring their ballots to those who are best placed to beat the far right, some may decide not to bother voting. Further complicating matters, Macron has ruled out governing with the party that makes up the largest component of the New Popular Front, the radical left-wing France Unbowed. If the National Rally does manage to secure an absolute majority, Macron would be obliged to nominate its 28-year-old president, Jordan Bardella, to the role of prime minister. He'd then be forced to share power with the far right in an arrangement known as cohabitation. Macron would retain control over foreign and defence policy, but would be humiliatingly diminished on the national stage. If no clear majority emerges for any single bloc, individual parties will likely try to form a coalition government within a fragmented parliament. Or the president could name a caretaker government of technocrats with no political affiliations. With a mandate until 2027, Macron insists he won't be stepping down, regardless of the results. Some of his own ministers have pulled out of the race to retain their seats in the bid to defeat the National Rally. Those who remain in office after the election have been given no precise instructions about how to proceed after the vote. It's possible that a transitional government will be in place for the Olympics, which begin in less than 3 weeks' time. Voters are casting their ballots today with no idea of who might eventually be able to form and lead a government. Calling the snap vote, Macron said he was seeking clarity from voters and urging them to reject a slide towards the extremes. But the move has left the country more polarised than before and facing into, at best, a period of deep political uncertainty, deadlock and stagnation. The only thing that's clear is that no matter its composition, the new parliament cannot be dissolved again until at the earliest next June. For World Report in Paris, this is Sharon Gaffney.
To Lebanon next. The country is home to more than a quarter of a million migrant workers who work for low pay, often in difficult conditions. Migrant workers, most of whom are women, have no labour rights and have a precarious immigration status. They're often subject to sexual violence and threats, as Hannah McCarthy reports from Beirut.
A choir of Filipino women sing hymns while another strums the guitar. At the altar beside them at the St. Joseph Church in central Beirut, a priest finishes Mass. A phone perched on a stand in front of the altar is streaming the Mass live for the migrant workers who haven't been allowed to leave work today to attend in person. The weekly church service is organised by the Afro-Asian Migrant Centre, a Jesuit-led initiative in Beirut. It delivers outreach and support to migrant workers who often face exploitative work conditions in Lebanon. After the Mass ends, the crowds of adults and children flow upstairs to eat a lunch featuring pancit noodles from the Philippines and rice dishes from Ethiopia. The African workers chat among themselves in the upstairs balcony area. Outside, two teams of Sri Lankan men gather in the church's car park to begin a cricket tournament. As their families and supporters gather at the sidelines and music plays over speakers, in a room off the main kitchen in the church hall, I sit down with a group of Filipino women. They speak different languages from the Philippines, Ilocano and Tagalog, but they say, with a laugh, they manage to understand each other enough. One woman says she's been in Lebanon for 20 years working for the same family. Do you like the family if you've worked for them for so long? I ask. Every family has its challenges, she says. The hours are always long, and we don't always get a break. She's been home four times since she left the Philippines, a country where over 2 million of their citizens work as domestic workers overseas, providing a steady stream of remittances. Lebanon is home to an estimated 250,000 migrant domestic workers, which the country relies on to care for children and the elderly for lower wages than the local population would accept. Many work 6 or even 7 days a week for a few hundred dollars a month, which is still more than they can hope for in their home countries. The economic crisis in Lebanon, which began in 2019 and which has worsened since the war in Gaza began, has meant domestic workers have faced cuts in pay and non-payments of their salaries. They have few options to force their employers to pay. Under Lebanon's migrant worker system, known as the kafala system, migrant workers do not have labour rights, and their employers can hold their passport and work permits, despite UN guidelines stating that confiscating passports is an indicator of human trafficking and forced labour because it restricts freedom of movement. The poor work conditions keep kafala workers in a state of precarity, both financially and in terms of their immigration status. This all makes it difficult to rebel against their exploitation. The vast majority of these domestic workers are women, with most coming from Ethiopia, the Philippines, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. Michael, the young American trainee Jesuit priest who runs the Afro-Asian Migrant Centre, explains that in Lebanon there is a sort of hierarchy among the domestic workers. Those who can speak English, French or Arabic are often better able to navigate Lebanon and defend themselves. In general, better trained English-speaking domestic workers from the Philippines tend to command a higher rate from Lebanese families than, for example, domestic workers from Ethiopia, who often face significant language barriers and racism in Lebanon, making them more isolated and vulnerable. But Michael says this hierarchy doesn't make any group immune from abuse or exploitation. He notes a recent study of 1,000 female migrant workers by the St. Joseph University in Beirut, which found that 2/3 of them experienced some form of sexual violence in Lebanon. 70% of the migrant workers who reported sexual violence inside the home said a male employer carried out the abuse. Many of the women were subjected to abuse from multiple perpetrators. 40% reported abuse by relatives and friends of the employers, while 25 to 30% endured abuse from female employers. The report also showed that sexualized violence towards migrant women happens everywhere. 65% reported experiencing harassment from taxi drivers and 50% by police officers. It's not uncommon for domestic workers in Lebanon to die or go missing, and when it happens, their families rarely access justice or even get clear answers on the cause of death. I spoke with a UN official who had spent time reviewing applications for resettlement overseas made by women from several African countries who had fled abusive employers in Lebanon. They said virtually every case file they'd reviewed had reported rape. But this Sunday afternoon of food and cricket at the St. Joseph Church is supposed to provide a few hundred migrant workers with some respite. for a few hours, those lucky enough to be allowed off work can eat food from their home countries and talk in their own language. For a few hours, they have no one to serve but themselves. For World Report, I'm Hannah McCarthy in Beirut.
Finally, we go to Canada. An international team has discovered the wreck of the last ship belonging to Ernest Shackleton. He was the famous Irish explorer of Antarctica. His boat, the Quest, was found off the coast of Labrador. Shackleton's death aboard the boat in 1922 brought to an end what many historians have described as the heroic age of Antarctic exploration. More from Dan Carpenchuk in Toronto.
The international team was organized by the Canadian Geographical Society. They found the Quest using sonar. It was sitting on its keel under about 400 meters of frigid water, with its tall broken mast lying beside it. Analysts say it likely cracked off as the ship sank after it struck ice in May of 1962. The expedition's search director, shipwreck hunter David Mearns, said it was up to him to interpret the sonar images they saw and to declare whether it was the Quest they had truly found. Mearns said to be part of the expedition to be able to find the Quest was a huge privilege in his life. The vessel was discovered on the fifth day of the expedition in the Labrador Sea, just as doubts were setting in and they were plagued by technical issues. The chief executive officer of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society and the expedition leader, John Geiger, said several days had been lost while the 23-member crew were trying to fix the technical issues, leaving only a small window where conditions were expected to be good. He said as they moved slowly, scanning the ocean floor, the technician looked away, but Geiger spotted something, a ship on sonar data. There was laughter and shaking of hands when they determined that they had indeed found the Quest, mainly intact. Geiger said the Norwegian-built ship, though damaged, appeared to be in what he described as incredible condition, where it had slammed into the seabed less than half a kilometer off Labrador's south coast. The ship had been lost for more than 60 years. Shackleton had died of a heart attack aboard the Quest in 1922. That was near the island of South Georgia in the South Atlantic during the voyage to Antarctica. He had led three British expeditions to Antarctica and was just beginning his fourth when he died. He was 47. Geiger said Shackleton had planned to take the Quest on an expedition to the north, to the high Arctic, but when the Canadian government said no to the trip, Shackleton decided to head back to Antarctica for the fourth time. Geiger called it a very important find. Historically, the final expedition of Sir Ernest Shackleton. The discovery process took 6 years for the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. The Quest remained in service for decades after Shackleton's death. It saw service during the Second World War as a minesweeper. Then, in 1962, it struck ice and sank. The second phase of the Geographical Society's expedition is to actually photograph and document the shipwreck and any artifacts. Search Director David Mearns says he hopes that trip will take place this summer, but the details have not yet been set. Mearns says the Quest is now a part of Canadian cultural heritage, Newfoundland cultural heritage, and world cultural heritage, a very significant shipwreck. Geiger said this year marks 150 years since Shackleton's birth, and when he discovered the ship that he had died on was lying off the coast of Labrador, he thought, we have to find it. Geiger said what motivated him to move forward quickly with the search was hearing that some Americans were also planning to look for the Quest. Shackleton's granddaughter, Alexandra Shackleton, was a patron of the Geographical Society's expedition, and in a statement she wrote, "It is perhaps fitting that the ship should have ended its storied service in Canadian waters. I have long hoped for this day, and am grateful to those who made this incredible discovery." For World Report, I'm Dan Carpenchuk in Toronto.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.